Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the June 28, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows Elon Musk. He's speeding down a two-lane highway in what looks like his electric truck, Tesla truck. I can't remember the name of it. It's convertible. Tops off. The back end is loaded with gold bars and bags of cash, as is the cab. Bills are flying in the wind as he speeds along. He's leaning out of the window, big smile on his face, and a handful of $100 bills in his hand. The headline is Wealth Accelerator, How Musk's $48 billion pay win is fueling supersized CEO compensation plans. And I believe that shows up as a business column. We'll see if we get to that today. Right now, the first main story. Heat dome brings extreme temperatures to the east. What happened? An unusually early heat wave scorched the Midwest and Northeast this week, breaking temperature records from Michigan to Maine and auguring a sweltering summer that may prove the hottest in recorded history. As a heat dome settled over the eastern U.S., some 270 million Americans baked under 90-plus degree temperatures, 15 to 20 degrees above historical norms, with heat index readings expected to top 100 in many locations. The National Weather Service issued its first-ever excessive heat warning in northern Maine, where temperatures were expected to reach 96 degrees, while Chicago broke a daily temperature record as it hit 97 degrees. The heat dome, a high-pressure system that traps air in place and bakes it with sunshine for days on end, follows record-breaking temperatures earlier this month in parts of California and the Southwest. Meteorologists forecast that this summer may be hotter than that of 2023, which itself was the Northern Hemisphere's hottest in 2,000 years. In California, firefighters battled at least six major wildfires. In Northern California, firefighters fought a blaze that spread over nearly 16 square miles. Another fire north of Los Angeles forced the evacuation of 1,000 people and scorched more than 15,000 acres. It's very early for a fire this magnitude, said L.A. County Fire Department spokesman Craig Little. Meanwhile, in southern Florida, cleanup was underway after severe storms dumped more than 20 inches of rain in 48 hours. Neighborhoods in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and other cities were left waist-deep in water. The aftermath looked like the beginning of a zombie movie, said Miami tow truck driver Ted Rico. Every year, it's just getting worse. What the columnist said. Heat waves don't topple buildings or flood cities, but they're federal disasters and should be treated as such, said Mark Gongoloff in Bloomberg. More than 30 environmental and health groups and trade unions petitioned the Federal Emergency Management Agency this week to classify heat waves as disasters qualifying for federal relief, and the agency should listen. Extreme heat is a killer that contributed to the deaths of a record 2,300 Americans last year. Federal disaster money would help local governments to build cooling centers, reach out to vulnerable citizens, and more, saving countless lives. In Florida, the rain has become political, said Lori Rosa in the Washington Post. The science is clear. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, leading to more rain and more extreme weather events. But Republican Governor Ron DeSantis pushed back against the idea that climate change helped fuel the recent storm, saying the downpour is not unprecedented. Last month, DeSantis signed a bill that eliminates references to climate change from state documents. "We don't want our energy policy driven by climate ideology," he said. "Meanwhile, Miami is entering a state of unreality," said Mario Alejandro Ariza in The Atlantic. Meteorologists called last week's storm a once-in-200-years event, but it's the fourth such deluge to swamp the region in as many years. And the sea keeps rising. Sunny day flooding has increased fourfold since 1998. Miami has spent millions of dollars to install pumps and otherwise upgrade its infrastructure. But as conditions worsen, it seems less and less equipped to ward off creeping catastrophe. "Climate alarm bells are ringing everywhere," said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. "Pre-summer heat waves have already slammed desperate stretches of the planet, from Bangkok to Barranquilla. In Asia, temperatures rocketed as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit in an arc from the Philippines to India. A decade ago, scientists put the odds of the planet warming 2.7 degrees higher than in pre-industrial times, the threshold that spells climatic disaster, by 2020 at nearly zero. Now the odds of that happening by 2028 are estimated at 8 in 10. "Remember this in November," said Paul Waldman in MSNBC.com. "President Biden has taken unprecedented action against climate change, enacting over 100 new environmental regulations and passing legislation that boosts clean energy and more. A President Donald Trump would roll back that progress. Biden's climate fanaticism will need a whole of government unwinding," declares Project 2025, the blueprint for a second Trump term drafted by his allies. "As the globe broils, climate denialism is no longer tenable. Now American voters have to decide whether they want to do anything about it." A controversy of the week. Supreme Court delivering a victory for abortion access. "What a relief," said Erwin Kamerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. The same Supreme Court that 2 years ago scrapped Roe v. Wade last week ruled that abortion opponents lacked the legal right to challenge the FDA's two-decade-old approval of the abortion drug mifepristone, or the agency's subsequent actions to improve its availability. This 9-0 decision to preserve access to mifepristone is crucial for reproductive rights. Some 63% of abortions are now medically induced, usually by mifepristone paired with another drug, misoprostol. Still, the case never should have gotten this far. A Christian group, Alliance Defending Freedom, had argued that anti-abortion doctors could suffer moral harm if they had to treat women with mifepristone-induced complications. No actual harm was demonstrated, but conservative judges on lower courts, acting out of their desire to restrict abortions, let the case proceed, ignoring basic rules about who can sue in federal court. In the High Court's majority opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote that allowing such a tenuous link to actual injury would mean every citizen had standing to challenge virtually every government action that they do not like. Even this ultra-conservative Supreme Court had to draw the line somewhere. So much for the left's denunciations of the court as Christian nationalist, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. This decision shows conservative justices putting the law first, even above their moral beliefs. The pro-life doctors argued they could be forced to participate in emergency abortions that would violate their conscience. But Kavanaugh rightly pointed out that federal conscience laws have protected anti-abortion doctors ever since FDA approved mifepristone in 2000. His defense of standing as a bedrock constitutional requirement is a textbook example of a justice affirming core judicial principles. This decision isn't a win for reproductive care, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. It is, at best, a reprieve. The ruling failed to address lower courts' acceptance of the plaintiff's shoddy science. U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, a Donald Trump appointee and former anti-abortion activist, ignored more than 100 scientific studies demonstrating mifepristone's safety in favor of two compiled by anti-abortion advocates that inflated the risk of complications and were later retracted. And Kavanaugh's decision explicitly leaves open two ways for abortion opponents to eventually prevail, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. He rejects the idea that no one else would have standing to sue the FDA. That's a nod to a looming challenge by Idaho, Kansas, and Missouri, which claim the agency's mifepristone rulings prevent them from fully enforcing their anti-abortion laws. More ominously, Kavanaugh mentions that plaintiffs could instead present their concerns and objections to the president and the FDA. Under President Biden, they wouldn't get anywhere, but if Donald Trump wins the White House, that's a different story. That's why this decision isn't nearly as important to abortion access as the 2024 election, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Trump has repeatedly said that he'll leave abortion to the states, yet his closest allies are pushing plans to curb reproductive rights nationwide, potentially by resurrecting the defunct 1873 Comstock Act, which outlaws the mailing of abortion drugs. Last week was what passes for a good week in abortion rights, but there remains a clear threat to access, and he'll be on the ballot come November. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for darkness, with reports that the Washington Post is seeking to broaden its appeal beyond the hardest, darkest news with a rebrand that will replace the paper's President Trump-era slogan, Democracy Dies in Darkness, with a more positive proposition. It was a good week for bangers after Taylor Swift fans danced so hard during the Pop Queen's three nights of concerts in Edinburgh that seismologists picked up earthquake readings nearly 4 miles from the venue. Tremors were strongest during the song Ready for It, when the crowd transmitted roughly 6,000 car batteries worth of power. It was a good week for double takes after 23 sets of twins graduated from Pollard Middle School in Needham, Massachusetts, making up 10% of the eighth grade class. It's quite unusual, said Principal Tamitha Bibbo. But it was a bad week for dads after Donald Trump benevolently wished a happy Father's Day to all on social media, including the radical left degenerates who are bringing the U.S. into third world nation status with their many attempts to influence our sacred court system. It was a bad week for spell check after Robert F. Kennedy Jr. campaign refiled its petition to get on the ballot in Nevada because the original declared that Kennedy's VP pick, Nicole Shanahan, was running for the office of Vice President of the United States. Finally, it was a bad week for double entendres after the Supreme Court rebuffed a California man's attempt to trademark the phrase, Trump too small, a reference to a crude joke about Trump's small hands by GOP Senator Marco Rubio in the 2016 primaries for the use on T-shirts. And the briefing, Mexico's criminal conglomerates. The country's cartels have expanded their operations far beyond drugs, infiltrating the legal economy and the political system. How do the cartels make money? Drug trafficking is still the big earner. Cartels make an estimated $12 billion annually from the sale of cocaine, heroin, fentanyl, and methamphetamine, mostly in the U.S. But in recent years, these organizations have diversified their criminal enterprises to include extortion, people smuggling, and arms dealing. And they have expanded into the legal economy as well. Narcos operate taxi and bus networks and tax avocado and lime growers. About 70% of lumber production in Mexico is now illicit, and roughly 30% of fuel sold in the country is stolen or smuggled. The crime gangs have also aggressively infiltrated local and regional governments, allowing them to direct public contracts for road building and other infrastructure projects to their preferred firms. While data is limited, it's thought the revenue from all of these schemes could rival the crime group's drug earnings. Today in Mexico, we have a mafia-like criminal landscape, said Romain Lecour Grandmaison of the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. Why did cartels diversify? Because they saw new opportunities for profit. El Narco is a monster that eats everything it can, said Mexico-based journalist Ion Griot. But this expansion is also a result of government policy. In 2006, then-Mexican President Felipe Calderón launched a war on the cartels, using the military as well as state and federal police to crack down on organized crime. Some 200,000 Mexicans were killed in 14 years of conflict, and the handful of big cartels splintered into many smaller ones. There are now more than 200 outfits employing a total of 150,000 people operating across the country. Many of these form shifting alliances with the remaining big players, such as the Sinaloa Cartel and Jalisco New Generation Cartel. To survive in this ultra-competitive and ultra-violent environment, the cartels began to diversify their portfolios to try to gain resources, said Eduardo Moncada, an expert on Latin American crime at Barnard College. Extortion has proved to be one of the cartel's most lucrative operations. How prevalent is extortion? About 20 million extortion crimes are reported each year, a huge number in a country of 128 million people. But the true total is likely far higher, because many victims are afraid to file reports with local police, who are often allied with the cartels. Almost every industry is subject to shakedowns, with small businesses proving to be especially tempting targets. At least 15% of Mexico's 135,000 mom-and-pop tortillerias are forced to regularly pay extortion, according to the National Tortilla Council. We're practically at the point where criminals set the price of tortillas, said council leader Homero Lopez. One shop owner in Cuernavaca, a city in southern central Mexico, told the Washington Post that thugs turned up 3 years ago asking for $10 a week to protect the neighborhood. Cuernavaca changed hands several times amid bloody gang battles, and the mob now in charge, demands up to $900 a month in protection. Those who don't pay risk having their shops or homes firebombed or strafed with bullets or being assassinated. What's the government doing? Not much. When the left-leaning Andrés Manuel López Obrador won the presidency in 2018, he declared the war on drugs over and enacted a new policy of hugs, not bullets. He scaled back cooperation with the U.S., dissolved the federal police, and tried to discourage young people from joining the cartels by expanding job training programs. With security forces on the sidelines, cartels focused on expanding and fighting rivals for territory. López Obrador's term saw a record number of murders, with at least 175,000 people killed in 6 years. President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum, a former Mexico City mayor and an acolyte of López Obrador, plans to continue his policies. She will start from below zero, said Guillermo Valdez, former head of Mexico's National Intelligence Agency. Criminals are more powerful. There is more violence. There is more political control of territory. How do the cartels secure political influence? Through bribes and force. In the run-up to this year's June 2nd vote, which included races for federal and state legislatures, governorships, and mayoralties, 37 candidates and dozens more people involved with elections were murdered, making this the bloodiest election in modern Mexican history. In the town of Maravatio, Michoacán State, gangs shot dead three mayoral candidates, including a respected doctor. Once in office, cartel-friendly polls can facilitate corruption and set police on their enemies. How does this affect the U.S.? It's contributed to the crisis at the southern border, where some 717,000 Mexicans were detained last year, triple the number in 2019. A Catholic aid organization reported that nearly 90% of the Mexican migrants it interviewed last year said they were fleeing violence, up from about 6% 8 years earlier. Some of those migrants couldn't afford to keep up with extortion payments. Others likely fled the social cleansing carried out when one gang seizes another's territory. But experts say the bigger danger to the U.S. is that the cartel's thirst for money could lead them to substantially expand their operations north of the border. Our cartel problem, said Rodrigo Villegas, a Mexico City-based political consultant, is your cartel problem. Moving into the best columns. The first two today come from the U.S. Preventing another 9/11. The terrorism warning lights are blinking red again, said Graham Allison and Michael J. Morrell. FBI Director Christopher Wray and other U.S. intelligence and military officials have been warning for months that the threat level of a terrorist attack on U.S. soil has escalated dramatically, with Iran and extremist groups such as Hamas, ISIS-K, and Al-Qaeda seeking vengeance for the killing of their soldiers and leaders. Terrorists could exploit the porous U.S. southern border to enter the country, and Wray has warned that homegrown violent extremists, so-called lone wolves, also pose a serious threat. In fact, terrorists have never stopped trying to strike. In 2022, U.S. officials broke up two foreign plots, one to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and another to assassinate former President George W. Bush. In recent months, leaders of ISIS-K and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula have issued videos calling for attacks on U.S. airliners and cities, just as Osama bin Laden did before 9/11. For the past two decades, America's intelligence and military communities have spared our country a second 9/11, but the work is not done. To prevent the unthinkable, policymakers need to take the warnings very seriously. The Trump film you may not see. A new movie called The Apprentice traces Donald Trump's rise to fame under the tutelage of his Machiavellian mentor, lawyer Ray Kahn. But American audiences may never see it, said Michelle Goldberg. The unflattering film features extraordinary performances by Succession star Jeremy Strong as Kahn and Sebastian Stan as the young Trump. And distributors in many countries have brought rights to show it. But U.S. movie studios reportedly became afraid to touch The Apprentice after Trump's lawyers threatened to sue and attack the film as foreign interference in Americans' elections. Corporations have seen the boycotts the MAGA right launched against Bud Light and Disney and fear that if Trump is reelected, he will actively use federal regulators to punish them. In his first term, Trump's Department of Justice tried to block AT&T's purchase of CNN's parent company, Time Warner, to punish the news network for its coverage of him. Trump ally Kash Patel has warned journalists and the media that if Trump gets a second term, we're going to come after you, whether it's criminally or civilly. The fear of releasing this movie in the U.S. is a sign of democratic decay, and it augurs greater self-censorship to come. This column comes from Mexico. The U.S. hands us a migrant mess. America's gift to incoming President Claudia Sheinbaum is a border crisis, said Nadine Cortez. Just 2 days after she was elected, President Biden issued an executive order effectively closing the border to asylum seekers. The Trumpian policy, intended to boost Biden's reelection bid by making him look tough on immigration, has profound and direct repercussions for Mexico. Shut out of the U.S., tens of thousands of Haitians, Cubans, Guatemalans, and other migrants from around the globe are left stranded in Mexico, overwhelming the country's already outstretched shelters and humanitarian resources. This crisis will be a baptism by fire for Sheinbaum, protege of outgoing President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who takes office in October. In the interim, López Obrador has requested that the U.S. deport the migrants to their countries of origin, not back to Mexico. But whether the U.S. complies depends on its goodwill. Even if some deportations proceed, Sheinbaum will face an immediate test of her ability to collaborate with the United States while also providing basic services to a growing population of desperate foreigners. And it will be tough for her to prepare, since she doesn't know whether she'll face President Biden or President Trump. And the last word, our feature article, leaving party politics behind. Americans are increasingly skeptical of political parties, said David Siders in Politico. In Colorado Springs, that's created an opening for independents and handed the local GOP to extremists. Colorado Springs. Yeme Mobolade, when I asked him how he made history here, slid a book toward me across the table in his office. Last year, Mobolade became the first non-Republican elected mayor of Colorado Springs, a development that would have seemed unthinkable for decades in a city known as a fortress of right-wing evangelical politics. The title says it all, he said. And then he read from the book's cover. A Declaration of Independence, How We Can Break the Two-Party Stranglehold and Restore the American Dream. A Nigerian-born former pastor and political newcomer, Mobolade told me that when he ran for mayor as an independent, he did it to represent people who don't like the party chaos, who live our quiet lives. Some of his biggest supporters, he said, are cowboys and cowgirls. And like him, he said, I've come to learn they don't like politics either. Which is why, as we sat in his office, Mobilati was predicting a tipping point for America's two parties sometime in the next half century, when they would lose their hold on the American political system, and explaining how it already happened here. Over the past 10 years, the number of independent or unaffiliated voters in El Paso County has more than doubled. And earlier this year, unaffiliated voters became a majority of the county's electorate. To political observers here, it was a sign of where the rest of Colorado and the country may be heading. In the past two decades, party affiliation nationwide has been on a downward trajectory, and the percentage of Americans who consider themselves political independents has been on the rise. The proportion of Americans who identify as independent now registers at about 43%, according to Gallup, while only about 20% of Americans identify as Republican and another 27% as Democratic. In Colorado, the percentage of independents is even higher, about 48%. For all the attention that third parties are drawing nationally this election cycle, some people don't see the rise of political independence as a threat to the country's dominant political parties. One reason is that research has long suggested that most independent voters lean toward one of the two major parties. But partisan lean and partisan affiliation are two very different things. And what is happening in Colorado Springs suggests to even longtime political operatives in Colorado that the party system as they know it may be starting to fall apart. It's not so much that voters' values are changing, it's that here and around the country, they are removing themselves from the party-led political process. And we're only beginning to understand the ramifications. It's one reason that the two parties may be increasingly beholden to fringe figures and less responsive to what voters say are their actual concerns. The parties are struggling to figure out how to respond. When I stopped in Denver on my way to Colorado Springs, Dick Wadhams, a former Colorado Republican Party chair and longtime party strategist, told me that the mayoral election and registration surge of unaffiliated voters in El Paso County had sent shockwaves through the ranks of political professionals in the state. That independents seem to be taking over in Colorado Springs is likely a surprise to anyone who followed politics in the 1990s. It was here that conservative activists dreamed up the Colorado State Ballot Initiative, barring anti-discrimination laws against gay people in 1992. The initiative was later ruled unconstitutional. Focus on the Family planted its headquarters in the city, as did many other evangelical Christian groups. A center of culture wars in the 1980s and 90s, it became known as the Evangelical Vatican. Then, in recent decades, Colorado Springs' population exploded, fueled by an influx of young professionals, and its policies began tugging to the left. Between 2016 and 2020, former President Donald Trump's margin of victory in surrounding El Paso County dropped by nearly 12 percentage points. 2 years later, Republican candidates for governor and the U.S. Senate carried the county by narrower margins still. The proliferation of unaffiliated voters doesn't mean that Colorado Springs is any less polarized or more centrist than the rest of the country. Locals' politics range the full spectrum. The week I visited, students at Colorado College had just dismantled the encampment where they protested the war in Gaza this spring. At the nonprofit Chinook Center, a left-leaning community center where the American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado claimed, in a lawsuit dismissed in April, that authorities were targeting activist leaders, a woman at the door told me she left the Democratic Party and re-registered as unaffiliated after Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, lost the presidential primary in 2016. President Biden, she said, is too conservative to gain her vote. There's also lots of evidence of right-leaning politics. The Gadsden flag, "Don't Tread on Me," flew outside a home nearby with a hand-printed sign in the yard that said, "Try God." And then there was Clarice Bacchus, who had tried God. She had been raised evangelical, she said, but who told me at the Vintage clothing store where she works downtown that she had left the Republican Party for unaffiliated when Trump was running in 2016. Now, she said, the world is as bad as it's ever been, and even more the last 4 years. In 2002, when there were proportionally fewer unaffiliated voters on rolls in Colorado, then Republican Governor Bill Owens won re-election with nearly 62% of the vote. That same election, the Republican running for state attorney general carried less than 38% against Democratic incumbent Ken Salazar. Salazar, after winning re-election to that seat, went on to become a U.S. Senator and now ambassador to Mexico. So there's a 25-point swing between Republican nominee for governor and attorney general, Wayne Williams, the Republican former Secretary of State, who lost to Mobilade in the mayoral race, told me. In other words, a quarter of the people in this state looked at the candidates and said, "You know, I really like the job Bill Owens is doing here. I really like the job Salazar is doing here." Fast forward to 2018, the year Williams lost his post as Secretary of State to a Democrat, and the Republicans running in a 5 statewide races all finished within about 2 percentage points of one another. The same kind of highly partisan party line voting seen around the country. So we went from 1 out of 4 voters splitting their ticket to 1 out of 50, Williams said. You were either with Donald Trump or you hated Donald Trump. And despite this vast increase in the number of unaffiliated voters, they are voting in a block more than they did when they were affiliated, which is quirky. It has also been problematic for the parties, if not the candidates running on their labels. That's because unaffiliated voters have less and less input into the people and priorities governing the two parties. The voters, Williams said, are no longer part of the party, so they don't make the decisions on party leadership. They don't choose who runs the party. The consequences of that may be far-reaching. When I called Lee Drutman, a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America, he told me that what interests him most is not the number of people who tell pollsters they consider themselves independent, but what they say about the parties. When Pew Research Center polled Americans last year, just 4% said the political system was working extremely or very well. And more than a quarter of Americans said they dislike both political parties, the worst reading in 3 decades. That's a big problem, Drutman said, because it reflects a profound sense of alienation about our political system, which is extremely discouraging at the very least, and potentially destabilizing at the worst. In Colorado Springs, the once dominant Republican Party shows signs of that kind of destabilization. Over in Arnold Palmer at a country club near his home, Larry Liston, a Republican state senator, told me, "I believe in the two-party system when they're vibrant." But Liston, a social conservative, said he runs into Republicans regularly who have left the party as hardliners have gained power. Their view being that if we were only further to the right and more dogmatic and more spiteful and more hateful, we would be winning these elections. But it's not just that the party is beset by infighting. That's happened in local Republican parties across the country in years after Trump's presidency. It's that as the party organization has become more insular, the apparatus itself on a small scale is splintering. Liston and like-minded Republicans have sought refuge in a separate entity, the Peak Republicans. A nod to Pikes Peak, the summit that serves as the backdrop of Colorado Springs. They needed the group, he said, because of the dysfunction of our party, which he described as being run by the crazies. With the lunatics that we have, Liston said, Ronald Reagan would not be considered Republican by them. There are structural reasons, like rules governing ballot access, and behavioral ones, like voters' desire not to waste their votes, that the two-party system has endured for so long. And if the rules remain the same, we will always have to, said Sarah Hagedorn, who worked as an aide to Senator John Thune of South Dakota and former Senator Conrad Burns of Montana, both Republicans, and who is now an assistant professor of political science at the Colorado Springs branch of the University of Colorado. But there is less reason to think that the two parties, as they exist today, will necessarily persist or persist in their current form. And speaking with people here, it seemed possible that if the two major parties ever do die, they might bury them in Colorado Springs. I asked Hagedorn, herself an unaffiliated voter now, what she thought would happen to the two parties if people kept abandoning them in her county. I think they're going to have to collapse and be built back up, she said. I don't know when, and it might be slow. It might not be an earthquake kind of thing. It might be something slow like an erosion. On the morning I met with him in Colorado Springs, Mobilati, or Mayor Yemi as people call him, had just held his monthly press conference where he was promoting the city's third place ranking in the U.S. News and World Report's Best Places to Live rankings for 2024-25. He was high on his city and on the long-term prospects of an alternative to the two-party system. In the next 20 to 50 years, he predicted, we're going to see the emergence of new parties. But Mobilati is also not unrealistic about the near-term prospects of his success being replicated statewide or nationally. Independents may be plentiful in the electorate, but they are scarce at all levels of government. Third parties have not figured out a way to elevate the vehicle and the infrastructure needed to be on par with the two-party system, he said. Mobilati said he knows the importance of a group of like-minded folks who share the same values, and together you can accomplish more than just individually. At the same time, his sense of himself as existing outside the political process seemed to me like a disposition that could be limiting for a political movement. I asked the mayor if the same feelings that caused him to register and run as an unaffiliated voter caused him to be less interested in attaching himself to a broader effort to expand his movement's ranks. If he were to, he said, it affiliates me now, right? These third-party institutions and systems are still institutions and systems. Like most Americans, he said, I'm a little jaded with any kind of institution or system. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Politico. Where we read one of the obituaries. The Lakers legend who forged a dynasty. Jerry West, 1938 to 2024. A force in basketball for five decades, Jerry West became so synonymous with the NBA that its very logo is his silhouette. As a guard for the Los Angeles Lakers from 1960 to 1974, he averaged 27 points a game and led the team to 9 NBA finals. A savvy passer with a lethal jump shot, he was known for both ferocity, frequently crashing the boards and breaking his nose 9 times, and poise under pressure, earning him the nickname Mr. Clutch. He went on to serve as a winning coach for 3 seasons, then an executive. He managed the Showtime Lakers of the 1980s through their dominance of the NBA, with 8 trips to the finals and 4 championships. But West was also known for his near misses. Of the 9 times he played in the finals, the Lakers lost 8. An intense, driven man, he was tormented by every loss. "The pain of losing," he said, "is so much stronger than the joy of winning." Lawson was born in West Virginia coal country, where his father, a mining electrician, bounced between jobs and beat him regularly, said the Washington Post. West found refuge in basketball, where he led his high school team to the state championship and earned a scholarship to West Virginia University, becoming a statewide hero when the team made the 1959 NCAA Finals, losing by a point. In 1960, he captained the U.S. Olympics team to a gold medal and was soon drafted by the Lakers. West made the NBA All-Star team all 14 of his seasons, said the New York Times, but injuries finally caught up with him, and in 1974, he retired as the 3rd leading scorer in NBA history. As a general manager, West made the Lakers one of the most valuable franchises in sports, said the Los Angeles Times. He engineered the signing of luminaries like Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, and while he was prone to yelling, players adored him. In retirement, he was angered by his raging foul-mouthed portrayal in the 2022 HBO docudrama Winning Time and demanded, but didn't get, a retraction. But West was just as hard on himself. In his memoir, he described himself as a sick competitor possessed of a demon-filled mind. "Fear of failure is the greatest motivational tool," he said in 2003. "It drives me and drives me and drives me." And on the opposite page here, we have that business column that was referenced in the cover drawing. Wind falls. Does Musk deserve a $48 billion payday? Elon Musk got his ransom, said Alex Kirshner in Slate. When a Delaware judge invalidated Musk's outrageous pay package in January, it was like a belated Christmas gift to Tesla's shareholders. Tesla already got the stock price increases it wanted when it made the 2018 offer, and now it could pay its CEO less, much less. Musk quickly threw a tantrum and threatened to build products outside of Tesla unless shareholders approved the pay package, worth $48 billion at Tesla's current share price. They did that overwhelmingly last week. At normal companies, the CEO works for the shareholders. But in Musk's bizarro world, Tesla's shareholders work for the CEO in hopes that he won't stiff them. Nobody was holding a gun to shareholders' heads, said Holman W. Jenkins Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. Musk's 2018 award granted him nothing unless he succeeded in creating an extraordinary and implausible increase in shareholder value, which he did. But it was, at the time, a risk. No other CEO would have signed it. Even so, last week's overwhelming vote in Musk's favor wasn't about gratitude. Investors were entitled to ask, "What are you going to do for me next?" They concluded that Musk is still the instrumental to Tesla's value, that Musk still has to fight the Delaware court to reverse its decision. The shareholder vote helps his case, said Hassan Chowdhury in Business Insider, and represents a vote of confidence in his leadership. Now Musk, who has been promoting an autonomous driving future for Tesla, has to deliver on his wildly ambitious promises. Musk supporters have somehow managed to turn this into a question of fairness, said Christian Hetzner in Fortune. Robin Denholm, the chair of Tesla's board, accumulated life-changing wealth thanks to Musk. Then she returned the favor, whipping votes for Musk's outsized pay package. This is how pay gets out of control. Supposedly independent directors with cushy and lucrative seats are happy to oblige their CEO patrons. Tesla's shareholders bought into the man as much as into the company, said the Financial Times in an editorial, and it paid off. However, Tesla is a singular example. The biggest danger is that executives elsewhere will mimic Musk by pursuing giant rewards and appointing supine boards. And we'll flip over to the talking point section. Time, I think, for one article here. Trump, a question of mental fitness. Is Donald Trump okay? Asked Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Over the past week, the presumed GOP presidential nominee has given us several frightening glimpses into a mind that is evidently unwell. At a Nevada rally, the 78-year-old embarked on a lengthy, muddled disquisition about whether it would be better to be electrocuted by a boat battery or eaten by a shark. He chose electrocution. At a campaign event in Detroit, Trump forgot the name of the doctor who administered the cognitive exam that he aced. And during a closed-door meeting between Trump and top CEOs, attendees told CNBC the former president was meandering and all over the map. We in the media have become inured to Trump's verbal incontinence, but it ought to be front-page news. President Biden, who is old, at least makes sense. Trump, who is also old, rants like someone you'd cross the street to avoid. How does he get away with it? Asked Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. When Biden, 81, mistakes a name or a place, the media pounces, claiming that he is showing, as a recent Wall Street Journal article filled with quotes from Republican lawmakers put it, signs of slipping. Yet when Trump spouts wild mistruths or rambles from one disjointed thought to another, there's no equivalent flurry or of press coverage. This double standard might be due to the fact that Trump appears more vigorous, at least at first glance, than Biden, who has spinal arthritis and walks like an old man. Trump is also benefiting from sheer superfluity of crazy, said Brian Klass in The Atlantic. His ludicrous statements don't drive the news because they become routine. But a president who occasionally misspeaks is far less worrying than one who repeatedly purveys delusional fantasies and conspiracy theories. The idea of this mentally unstable man serving a second term should terrify any American voter, said Tom Nichols, also in The Atlantic. The grown-ups who managed Trump's cognitive and emotional issues first time around are gone, never to return. His next White House will be staffed with nothing but toadies pre-vetted for loyalty. There will be no responsible or experienced civil servant in the Oval Office if the day comes when someone has to explain to Trump why the Chinese or Russians have put their nukes on alert, and he starts talking about frying sharks with boat batteries. The 45th president is unwell, and he should not serve as the 47th. And we'll pick up a few of the short notes. Violent crime dropped 15.2% nationwide in the first 3 months of the year compared with the same period in 2023, with murders and rapes both falling about 26%, according to FBI statistics. Murders plummeted by more than 40% in cities such as New Orleans, Philadelphia, and Seattle, and Boston. Crime analysts say if such figures hold steady, we may see the largest one-year decline in murders in U.S. history. Nearly 90% of House Republicans, including Speaker Mike Johnson and Majority Leader Steve Scalise, last week voted in favor of a failed measure to restore a Confederate memorial to Arlington National Cemetery. The monument, removed in December, features an enslaved black mammy holding the infant child of a white Army officer and an enslaved black man following his owner into battle. More than 171,000 American women are estimated to have traveled across state lines to get an abortion last year. That's double the number who traveled out of state for an abortion in 2019 and accounted for nearly a fifth of recorded abortions. China is on track to double its arsenal of nuclear weapons over the next 6 years. The country's nuclear stockpile grew from 410 operational warheads to about 500 over the past year and is expected to hit 1,000 by 2030, about the same number as the U.S. or Russia has. On the poll watch, 23% of Americans say they will vote only for candidates who are pro-choice. 8% say the same about pro-life candidates. Overall, 54% consider themselves to be pro-choice, and 41% say they are pro-life. And finally today, a quote from Joseph Heller, who says, "Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you." Think about that one. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.